I'm Frank Vaughn. It's May 8th, 2026. Seems I'm on an unscheduled sabbatical this week. It's been kind of slow. I've been kind of checked out. I got to be honest with you. I get sick of hearing myself talk. You get sick of hearing me talk. You're not alone in that. When your ego is not tied to your online production, it's very easy to tune out. And I've said a lot of things over the last 15, 16 months. And most of it remains true right now. And we're all sort of subject to the whims of the world, waiting for events to unfold. And, you know, there's some other stuff going on. It's not just the lower body injury, which I am dealing with, and the life changes that are resulting from that. I'm not even kidding or being in any way facetious or exaggerative. It's a life change that is overdue, about 7 years overdue. Since I started having kids, really. And it's not the kids that did it. It was the change in my life that happened because I had kids. My whole life changed. And I was used to being somebody who could consume 4,000 to 5,000 calories every single day and easily burn it off because that's what my work did for me. And the work, the physical work, the sweat and the blood, it kind of went away. But the eating remained. And so I have delayed gratification written in my Twitter bio. And I have not been practicing delayed gratification when it comes to food for a long time. So I need to live up to my own words. Because at the end of the day, injuries are caused by unhealthy bodies. And this whole body positivity movement telling people that they are healthy at any size and they're beautiful at any size, it's just all a bunch of lies and excuses to tell fat people they're fine the way that they are. And as a fat person talking to maybe fat people in my audience, we're not fine the way we are. And we should be honest about that. Just like we should be honest about other things that are physical realities that cannot be changed by identity or other such fantastical constructs. So anyway, I'm engaged in fixing that. The other thing that happened, and, you know, we'll talk about the news a little bit at the end, you know, if that's what you're here for, zoom ahead if you want. I'll just give you a summary. I'm not going to get into great detail today because I think it's all a Sitzkrieg. It's, you know, live action role play that there's a ceasefire when really everybody's bombing everybody. You know, they say the UAE once again claims to have intercepted everything, but there's video coming out of the UAE of big smoke plumes rising from the international airport there. Everybody in Dubai is very quiet and mum and doesn't want to share social media video, don't want to talk about it because you get arrested and put in jail for telling the truth. So it's a pretty intense fog of war. But the other thing that happened on a personal level is I got a phone call about a week ago. I don't remember how long ago now, maybe a week and a half ago. And it was to inform me that one of my uncles died. And he was an uncle by marriage. I grew up with him as an uncle. I know him as an uncle, but he's not like a direct descendant of either one of my parents. And so that happened, and I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm not fishing. I'm going to talk about how life is because I'm 46. It starts at different ages for people, but this is a process that's been ongoing for me for a while, where you hit a certain age, and the people that you grew up with, they fade away. They go. It's just the way of life, right? And so it occurred to me that this uncle was the last uncle. There are none left. Out of a whole, I don't know, dozen uncles that were out there, they're all gone. And that includes, well, it doesn't include my father, obviously, but my father's part of that litmus. All of these men that I looked up to, all of this life that they lived together and the things that they did and the memories that I have of them are all past tense. And the vast majority of it, 99% of it, will likely be gone from memory, from living memory, in the next 50 to 80 years. The things that they did, the individual jokes and memories, they're going to die out with me for the most part. There will be some pictures. There will be words that I carefully write to pass down to my kids. There will be a history of sorts. But the actual living memory is gone. And it's a pretty wild thing when you think about it, because now you're on the front line of it. You're next in line. You're moving forward through time. And you're the one that everybody's looking up to. You know, you got kids, they're looking to you for answers. They're looking for to you for guidance. They're looking to you for protection. And that's a big thing that you have to, it's a big challenge and it's a big piece of responsibility that you have to rise to. And the other thing that happens is people get sick. And somebody that I very much care about is very sick, very important to my family, is sick in a way. And, you know, it's changed how things operate. I don't want to overstate what it is because, you know, it's one of those kind of sicknesses that could go on for a long time or, you know, truth be told, hopefully this person never watches this video, but truth be told, you know, maybe it doesn't go on for a long time. You don't really know. And so you have to make some rapid adjustments on the fly and make some changes. And, you know, I've known this information for a little while, and I've been making plans this summer for how we were going to camp our way across the country to make sure that we see this person and you know, make some changes because they ain't going to be coming to us. I had to pause for a second and actually collect my thoughts because, you know, sometimes the mixture of the responsibility that you have to your kids and the responsibilities that you have to life creates quandaries. And one of the quandaries that I came across that is forcing me to alter my plans is my cat, of all things in the world. My cat, my 14-year-old gray fuzzy cat. And the entire story of how this cat came into my life is pretty magical. I used to do a farmer's market in a little town called Campbellford, Ontario. And every morning, I'd show up there at 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the morning. I'd begin my day setting up, and my wife and I would be there when she became involved in my life. And there was this town cat named Smokey. I don't think anybody knew where Smokey lived. Smokey kind of lived in a bunch of different houses. Like, I don't really understand. I still, to this day, don't understand how Smokey worked. But Smokey was a cat that had been through a lot. He had one ear that didn't stand up anymore. He had some battle scars, but he was this big gray boy, and he was awesome. And he'd stop by the stall, and he'd lay amongst my plants, and he'd hang out, and he'd get his pets. And then when he was done, he'd just wander his way downtown to wherever it was he went. Like a human, this cat just went about his business every single day. And from about 2006 to 2011, that was a feature of my life. It was this Smokey cat coming and visiting. And I always used to think, you know, I want a cat just like that. I want a big, gray puffball. That's what I want. Didn't know how I was ever going to find it. Didn't put much energy into it. But I thought, you know, I'd love to have a Smokey cat. So 2011 comes along. And I'm in a moment of, we'll just call it intense stress and duress. There's things going on that have got me very concerned and very worried. I'm losing sleep. My hair is turning gray. You know, it was a rough time in my life. And in the middle of the peak of that crisis, I'm at market one day. I'm actually inside a building. I had just taken a leak. And I'm walking back, and my wife, she signals at me frantically. She signals at me, and she goes, just like that. And I knew, because my wife and I know each other fairly well, that she was telling me that there's a little kitten somewhere, or there's a little fur ball, something like this, and it's over there. So I go walking, and there's this cat that would literally fit in the palm of my hand with room to spare, with its little tail probably not even coming back. A kitten probably a week old, maybe 2 weeks old. Like, we're talking super young, pretty well dead, like maybe a day from dead. Its eyes were practically shut from being dehydrated. It was scrawny and skinny and just really rough shape. So I picked it up, and I took him in the back of the truck. I went and bought some kibble, and I broke up the kibble, and I started hand-feeding it to the cat. And it was funny, because this cat is half-dead, and I'm feeding it these little chunks of kibble. Got it in my sweater. It's fall, so, like, the cat's really cold. And as I'm feeding it these chunks of kibble, it's batting at the string on my hoodie. So even in its state, it was still quite playful. And it's funny, because 14 years later, he's still very playful. He's always up for a fight. Like, he's always, he wants to play with string. He wants to fight with you. Like, he's always up for it. He's very energetic. At any rate, he came to me in this moment of crisis. And this furball that's never said a word to me has been there through every single milestone of my life, including when I brought my son home. I didn't know how he was going to react. The cat had never really seen a lot of toddlers. People don't have big families anymore, so I don't have a lot of little kids running around the house when I was back on the farm. And the one time we had some toddlers come in, his eyes bugged right out. He had no idea what to do with little humans. He didn't do anything, but he definitely looked bugged out a little bit. And I remember I brought my son home, and it was like the cat knew. It was like he had watched my wife's belly grow. He had watched how, like, I remember how the cat stuck by her the whole time she was pregnant. Like, he used to like to lay on her and get his pets, right? And he couldn't lay on her anymore because she was huge. We had big kids. And I probably shouldn't say that about my wife, but whatever. She was huge, man. 2 days before she gave birth, she looked like she was going to explode. But it was like I brought the kid home. We had him in a bassinet. I put him there by my chair on the floor, and the cat came walking in, sniffed him a couple times, didn't get sketchy, just laid down beside him, and that was it. Cats never clawed them. He's put up with, I mean, when they were little kids, you know, not knowing, like a year, 2 years old, they would double fist, grab handfuls of fur on him and try and pick him up. And Fuzzy won't, like, if I tried to do that to Fuzzy, he'd fight me. Like, he would claw me if I did that to him. But the kids, they got a free pass. You know, and the cat's never, he's never peed outside his litter box. He's never done anything, you know. He claws the couch a little bit sometimes, and even that he doesn't do much of. He's just been this perfect cat. Anyway, last September, we went away for a week. I had to help somebody move from one place to another, and we went away for a week. And we come back, and the cat's being weird, and we forgot, you know, we've been gone for a little while. He's just being weird, right? And he wasn't eating much food, and we thought, you know, he'll bounce, whatever, and time went by, weeks went by, months went by, and I guess the cat just wasn't eating, or wasn't eating much. He was picking at his food, and he got thinner. And I watched this process happen, and I thought, he's 14, you know, his age is catching up with him, right? Like, cats get thin, they thin out, you know, I've seen it before in other cats. But then eventually I realized something's really wrong, and, you know, it's Fuzzy, I love my cat, so started experimenting with different foods, and, you know, there was a couple I tried, he didn't like them. But there was one he took to. He started eating again. And this cat, I'm telling you, he bounced. Put on all the weight, put all his weight back on, and he is restored to normal function. And life went on. So here I am planning this trip for months, planning this idea of camping my way across the country and doing whatever I can do with that, and going to see this family member that I was talking about. And my wife and I were talking about our plans, and she says to me, well, the last time we left, the cat almost died. I said, what do you mean he almost died? He was fine. And then we went over events again, and I'm like, holy, you're right. It started when we left. Stupid me. I didn't really pick up on that. So I start looking online about cats and how they bond with people and, you know, what can happen when they don't have their people around. And I realized that I learned that there's this thing called stress-induced anorexia in cats. Who knew? And everything I read, it fits the bill. The cat probably associates that food that he had been eating his entire life. He probably associates that taste and smell with us not being here. And that's why he will never touch the food he ate his entire life ever again. So this is a long story about a cat. He's a pretty special cat, though. So he bounces and she says this to me. And that's when I realize I got a bit of a quandary. Because I can't just bail on the cat. I can't just build Kibble Mountain and big water pool for him and have somebody pop in every, you know, for 10 minutes every other day or every third day to check on him and whatever. Like, it's just not going to be enough. It's going to kill the cat. And so I've, at times, you know, we've put deer on the counter and carved it up. I've had to shoot things in my life. I don't enjoy it. You know, I never enjoy killing things. It's not like something I celebrate, but I do enjoy having meat in the freezer. And I do enjoy not having the damage that animals can sometimes cause. And like you know, if you live in the wilderness, you have to deal with animals sometimes, and it's not always the same. And, you know, but the cat's a little bit different, right? It's not only is he my pet, and obviously with the story I've just told you, it's a pretty special relationship that we have. but he's also the kid's first attachment, first pet. He's part of the family. Ever since we had this realization about the stress-induced anorexia thing, I've realized the cat's always around. He's always hanging out. You think of cats as independent. One of the reasons you have cats is because you can leave them, right? This is the story I've been telling people for 14 years. He's a cat. I'll just leave him. Well, it turns out that's not quite accurate, and this cat is always around us. We don't gather together in a room that cat doesn't show up. Like, he's part of it. And the kids love him, and they hug him, and they pet him, and they treat him really good. And I can't just shove him in a boarding house because he hasn't been in a boarding house his entire life. That'll probably kill him, just like I almost killed him when we left last September. Can't leave him alone, obviously. I don't think there's nobody around that I can just put in the house to keep the cat company. And you might think to yourself, it's a cat, dude. What's the big deal about a cat? And I'm with you. He's a glorified rodent that lives in my house. Really, if you want to break it down to brass tacks. But of course, he's not just those things. He has a relationship with my kids. He's their first pet love. He's going to be, hopefully, if all things go according to my plans, he's going to be their first tragedy. Hopefully it's not someone else. Eventually the cat will go, and they'll have to learn and adjust to that. How I treat the cat, what I do in this situation, has an impact on the rest of their lives. And so it's not just a simple matter. And why am I telling you that story? Half the time I don't even know. It's just to say that sometimes, things take on a meaning that is far beyond what they physically alone constitute. The glorified rodent that lives in my house has all of these complex moral and compassion and sympathy and care issues and responsibility issues that will influence my children down through time. This furball, has such a bigger impact. And it's pretty wild. But anyway, it's all that is to say, I've noticed the audience has gotten tired with my content constantly coming out. I think the more, this is one of those things that accuracy is sometimes rewarded by people tuning out. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want to understand how dangerous a situation we're in right now. We're already in it, man. The energy crisis we're coming into, people think it's not real. But physical supply being constrained in the way it is eating through inventory, and eventually that inventory runs out. And first it's going to affect countries we don't care about, all the poor plebs that nobody wants to think about, the people we bomb, the people the Americans love to bomb and kill that they don't care about. Those are the people who are going to be affected first. Then it'll move to Japan and South Korea and some people that we do care about. And then eventually some of those things are going to come home to shore. And the whole time, the entire world economy is going to come unraveled. That is something, if it's recessionary and it only lasts a year or two, that's the best case scenario. It's going to be bad for a while. And we're not feeling it yet, folks. We're still eating last year's food, okay? Aside from fresh produce and everything else, but the cereals and the bread and the wheat that you're eating right now, you're eating last year's supply. Forgive me the interruption. I have another refugee from Ontario moving out to Saskatchewan, and I'm helping them with that process. You're eating last year's supply, and as I drive around, I had to go out and do some business yesterday. The family and I were driving around. There is standing water everywhere. There should be, actually no, the giant dust plumes of people seeding should be fading away by now. And instead, there's not a single field that's been touched. There's not a single field that's been seeded. It's May 8th. There's a very limited grow season in Saskatchewan. And this is, we're not talking about fertilizer prices. We're not talking about the drought in the United States, which is another fact. We're not talking about the issues of under-fertilization and how that's going to affect yield in other parts of the world. We're talking about right here, where there is availability at an increased price because fertilizer costs are up here. Just because we produce potash doesn't mean the price isn't going up. But the fields aren't even getting planted across wide regions. And this is in the midst of a financial hardship crisis as costs have gone up because of the war, directly because of the war. And I just see the future in these barren fields. I see an amplification of what's happening in the rest of the world, and this is what's already happening. This isn't about the future. It's not about what comes next. Because if you're believing Donald Trump and his true social posts, even when they contradict each other from one post to the next, you're not seeing the world accurately. The United States is in trouble in the Middle East. They're trapped, caught between a rock and a hard place. They're caught between hubris and the realities of politics and the realities of the world and the economy. I don't think there's any saving Trump at this point. I don't think there's any saving the Republican Party. I don't think there's any saving MAGA, no matter what happens. But I don't think there's an exit to be found the way that the Americans want it. They want to dictate terms to the Iranians. The Iranians aren't going to be dictated to. They are happy. I keep seeing all this press from Bessent and Trump and Hegseth and all these commentators. Jesse Waters, man, just go become the press secretary for the White House. You're not a media man anymore. You're amplifying the message. And the message is the Iranians are on the verge of collapse. They're not. And the CIA knows it. There is a report. I guess I'll do one thing here today. This has been picked up by a lot of things. And Zero Hedge, you know, some people say, why do you read Zero Hedge? It's very useful right now for the same reason that Al Jazeera is. Because Zero Hedge is definitely pro-Trump. And when they are forced to cover something that directly contradicts what the administration is saying, you can pretty much guarantee that it's something you can sink your teeth into. The headline on screen is CIA leak, Iran can survive blockade another 3 to 4 months, maybe longer, because they're used to suffering. They have been built for suffering. One of the things I'd love to get into on this channel is how fortified their economy is. Not just that they are surrounded by mountains and protected. It is the world's natural fortress. It's what they've had to do to adjust to the realities of being crushed under sanctions. In effect, the sanctions aren't as crushing as everybody would like to believe. That's why they haven't worked. That's why they didn't work before the war. And the war won't work because there's no actual capacity to change the regime. There's no actual capacity to invade Iran. There's no actual capacity to force them to the table. They gain more the longer this goes on. Even though they're taking losses, don't get me wrong, they lose economically. But I mean, look how powerful they are. They fly to Russia. They fly to Emirate countries. They're talking about a new Gulf framework in the wake of this to protect and project power across the Gulf. The United States appears powerless to do anything about it. They're going to China. The foreign minister goes to China and has a very good meeting. There's a lot of spin. Some people spin it as the Russians and the Chinese abandoned the Iranians. You have to be really committed to the fantasy of the unblemished immortality and inability to make mistakes of the Trump administration to believe that the Iranians have been abandoned by their allies. It's pretty wild. Like, the spin is off the charts right now. The CIA, Trump's own intelligence agencies, recognize that the Iranians are willing to draw this out. So again, it's a rock and a hard place, and we're being told ceasefire is doing fine, even though bombs are falling both ways. And this is all the whole idea of trying to maintain the illusion of the ceasefire is to simply get out of the obligations of the War Powers Act. It was the same thing they did when they said, oh, Epic Fury's over. Now we're on to Project Freedom. Trump does not want to go back to Congress because he knows if he has to go to Congress, he's going to get shut down. And so he's got this period between now and November to try and fix this mess. We're also coming up on the NAFTA negotiations. It's not NAFTA, but the USMCA. Coming up on the USMCA, there's been very little press coverage about that, other than Carney saying we have to divorce from the United States, even though his money's parked down there, even though his assets are down there, even though he built a life down in the United States. I don't believe his rhetoric for 1 minute. I think we're all being played. I think this man is here to reorganize Canada, and I think North American integration is his agenda, and he's doing it under the elbows-up aegis. He does not mind lying to the plebs. And that's how he sees his own voters. That's why he got them out there doing the chicken dance with their elbows up. They all look like morons. And they're laughing. They're laughing at the people who enable them and empower them and who 45 to 48% of the Canadian public will vote for the Liberal Party. They're laughing at you. They're gaslighting you. But at any rate, I called it the Sitzkrieg. I called it the stalemate. We're in this interregnum, so to speak, where we've had two chapters of the war. They were inconclusive AF. The third chapter, which, I mean, I've been waiting for it to start for 2-3 weeks now. I think we have another window of opportunity this weekend because it's always on the weekend. The Iranians have actually, let's go back, bring up Al Jazeera for a minute. Iran warns U.S. of new quagmire, denounces reckless military adventure. Rubio presses Europe on Iran action as he seeks to mend ties. Iran president says colonialism exploitation has no place in the world. CENTCOM says U.S. forces have redirected 57 vessels to enforce blockade of Iranian port. All I'm trying to highlight is I think the Iranian position is intransigent. They're dug in. They're not moving. The American position is intransigent. They're dug in. They think they can just dictate terms. You're going to give up the uranium. You're going to give up the Middle East. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. Do the other thing. They're not in a position to make those demands. I keep hearing the Trump administration talk about, oh, they got to get back to the negotiating table. It's the Americans who aren't negotiating. The Americans, what they're calling negotiation is them issuing an ultimatum saying, you're going to do this or we're going to bomb you, your civilization, into the Stone Age. And the Iranians keep saying, no. Go ahead, do your worst. We're going to sit here and wait. You have to fire the first shots. And so we have this tit-for-tat stalemate. I think it ends because the United States is moving basically the sum total of all of their conventional military power is being concentrated in the Middle East. Sure, they could send some more carrier groups, but it's a buildup. It's a buildup over time. They got a lot of munitions. Their assets are ready to go. It's just a matter of pulling the trigger. And of course, the Israelis still want this war to continue. They desperately want it to continue. And eventually, I think they will. You know, it's interesting. There's been some missiles and drone strikes on the UAE. And some of them, the Iranians have said, we didn't do it. Who do you think might have done that? Do you remember there was a pair of ballistic missiles that supposedly landed in water off Diego Garcia, I believe it was, which was supposed to be out of the range of the Iranians. And there was splashy news for a day about how the Iranians have missiles that can go further than anything that we imagined. And the Iranians came out and said, we didn't fire those missiles. And the story disappeared. It was whitewashed away, and we never heard about it again. Who fired those missiles? We're in a moment of false flaggery. And the interesting thing is that I think it's obvious which nation is engaged in trying to do false flags. And I think it's interesting that those false flags are designed to trigger a U.S. military response to make sure the United States military, men, treasure, everything, gets recommitted to the war effort. And yet, the victim, the target, whose actions are trying to be teased out by the person, by the party doing the false flags, if there's false flags. I mean, it's the fog of war. It certainly looks like it to me. The party that's doing the false flags looking to drag the United States into war is being covered for by the United States media and by the United States administration. They're covering for the people who are trying to set them up and get into this big war. And then we're told that that particular nation has no power over the United States and its politics. Good story. Cool story, bro. Anyway, don't want you guys to think I'm done or I'm gone or anything, but, you know, you're tired of hearing me talk. I'm tired of listening to me talk. There's a lot going on in my life. Bit of a sabbatical. A lot of changes. But don't think I'm out of the game.